Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. And this week's show is brought to you by Trail of Bits, the security engineering firm. And yeah, they are here this week to talk about ZK Docs, a bunch of documentation they've put together to give people guidance on how to implement some of these newfangled concepts like zero-knowledge proofs that are popular in blockchain and crypto land. And it's funny because a few years ago, Trail of Bits started messing around with blockchain, you know, security engineering work. And now they tell me, initially they started doing this because they just found it interesting. And now they tell me they have like 15 staff members working on crypto and blockchain stuff full time. So it's actually turned into kind of a specialty of theirs. So yes, Dan Guido from Trail of Bits will be along in this week's sponsor interview to talk about why your implementation of a crypto concept from an academic paper probably sucks. That is coming up later, but first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, the first story we got here, it's chock full of cyber war.
Yes, we have a report from Belarus talking about the situation, you know, obviously between Russia and Ukraine, where Russia is positioning forces, you know, towards the north of Kiev in Belarus, and they've been using the railway system in Belarus to, you know, move troops around. We may recall that a few months ago we talked about the cyber partisans, a group in Belarus that have hacked a whole bunch of the state security apparatus and other government agencies and functions, and, you know, doxed a bunch of people that work there, and otherwise done some, you know, relatively sophisticated looking, you know, previously insider perhaps hacking on stuff. Anyway, this group has now come out and said that they have kind of ransomed, I guess, the state railway system that they've broken in, crypted a bunch of boxes, deleted a bunch of backups, and have then posted a message out on Telegram saying, we are doing this to prevent the use of our rail system to position Russian troops in the country. We have all the key material. We're willing to turn the railway system back on. And this is things like, you know, ticketing, online ticketing and stuff's currently unavailable. We're willing to turn it on if you release some people, political prisoners who are in need of medical assistance, and if you prevent the presence of Russian troops in Belarus.
Yeah.
Which, yeah. I mean, the cypherpunk in me from the 90s is like, oh, shit, yeah, that's, dang, like, wow, nation states going to war.
Yeah, we love the vibe. We love the vibe of this thing, right? But you got to ask, to what extent disabling the Belarusian government's ability to issue tickets to train passengers is going to interfere with Russia's plans?
Yes, right. The effectiveness of this, we don't really know. We also don't really know how much, like what percentage of this is psyops, you know, is necessarily true versus, you know, what's, you know, actually happened in the networks. They did release a bunch of screenshots that look pretty compelling. They've like kind of followed up with, you know, a bunch of technical things that, you know, does make it look very credible in terms of the technical aspects of it. And obviously they've been effective in the past, but effective in terms of, you know, actually doing technical things, but what that means politically, whether that, as you say, will stop Russian, you know, military logistics, we don't really know. But I mean, I read this and I was like, this is the, you know, cyberpunk future that I thought we were going to get, not
the one that we actually mostly did get. Yeah,
yeah, no, like not NFTs and cryptocurrency, you know?
Yeah, my apes, they're gone. I mean, it's 2022, man. It's wild. But yeah, I mean, look, I think the thing is, this comes back to that old chestnut where, you know, cyber operations are useless as a deterrent, right? I think we've kind of established that. Cyber operations in war are going to be useful for things like intelligence collection to figure out things like targets, right? And to get, you know, information that you can then feed to your military apparatus. I just don't know how effective stuff like this, and, you know, we saw the defacements of a bunch of websites in Ukraine and whatever. Ooh, big psychological operation. I don't know really how much those sort of things move the needle, if I'm going to be honest. I mean, especially after we're, you know, 2 years into a global pandemic that's seen everything from, you know, toilet paper stripped to the shelves and chicken shortages and, you know, just essential services kind of breaking down a little bit through this Omicron wave with so many workers furloughed and stuff. And then, you know, who's really going to care that a website got defaced or that, you know, they have to buy a paper ticket with cash or something to get on the train? I just really feel like we're almost getting to that time where we can put the concept of cyber war kind of to bed, you know?
I mean, obviously, I want to believe in the cyber war. Like, I want to feel like I personally am empowered to do things, you know, that would mean something, you know. But I suspect you're probably right. Like, we just really haven't seen great evidence. I mean, turning the power off in Ukraine, you know, that was a good effort. Not Petya, kind of accidental, but still good effort in terms of global logistics and stuff. But yeah, it's just not the cyber war that we were promised.
No, but I don't know what the cyber war we were promised really was, because no one was really ever able to articulate what it would be.
It was always a bit nebulous, wasn't it?
And yeah.
And I think, like, in terms of the psyops aspect, like, I mean, everyone these days expects computers not to work and expects government IT systems to be broken anyway. So
this is kind of what I'm getting at with the comment around the pandemic. I mean, we're trying to get a passport for my baby son at the moment, and you cannot contact the Australian passport office at the moment. Like, you can't ring them. They just say, we've got too many calls, bye-bye. And if you do get past that step, you go through like 5 minutes of IVR, and then it says, we're transferring you, and then the call disconnects, right? And, you know, so a couple of defaced websites. And that's in Australia, where we're not about to be invaded by Russia, right? Well, I hope. But I don't think we are.
It is, right? Indistinguishable from cyber war. Just trying to operate a normal government IVR phone system.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. So look, depressing. But I mean, we admire their moxie, right?
We do. Like top effort, and like, I mean, I think they've delivered. It's just that, as you say, like, maybe the cyber war doesn't really have the same impact as, you know, dropping a bomb or blowing stuff up.
Well, and using cyber means to obtain information about where to best place those bombs. I mean, absolutely. That makes sense. Yeah. You know, it's obviously going to be a component of warfare. You know, you might even flick the lights once things get rolling. You know, you might switch off a couple of power stations. I don't know. We haven't seen yet. But this whole concept of a full-scale cyber war, you know, cyber assault, it just, I mean, I feel like almost, we can almost put this to bed.
Yeah, although, you know, it's like, I guess the ball is in the Russians' court to show, you know, that you can cyber war and do effective things with it, and, you know.
Yeah.
Sadly, they may get the opportunity to do so.
Well, look, staying on the topic of Ukraine, Dmitry Smilyanets over at The Record did this fantastic interview with a Ukrainian security official and published it as a Q&A at The Record. There was some interesting stuff in here. This guy's name is Serhiy Demiduk. I've probably completely butchered his name. I do apologize to any listeners in Ukraine for that. But look, what he has to say is very interesting. You know, he sort of speculates that some of these wiper attacks on Ukrainian targets recently looked like they may have been put together with the assistance of people who know a lot about ransomware. And I found that very interesting. Now, he could just, you know, he's obviously got an agenda, and that's fine. But you look at what he says, and it all sounds kind of reasonable.
It's a very, very interesting interview. And this is a follow-up for one that Dmitry did late 2020, I think it was, with the same guy. And he's asked a few questions about how things have changed. But yeah, there's a couple of points. I mean, that one about, you know, him kind of intimating that some of the tooling used in the most recent Ukrainian government mass defacement / you know, sort of fake ransomware that was actually a wiper. And he says, yeah, there's some kind of technical evidence that this is shared with actual ransomware, you know, with some bits removed. He makes a few jabs at the Ghostwriter people out of Belarus. And we were talking a bit about whether or not we thought Belarus was involved, you know, in helping the Russians out in this particular campaign. But yeah, the thing where he kind of says, you know, isn't it funny that the Revil crew got picked up about the same time as we're seeing very ransomware-esque tooling being used? And that was an interesting, you know, interesting angle. He also had some great things to say about sort of the interaction between Ukrainian government trying to push the private sector there to, you know, cooperate on security issues, and how seriously people take it. It's just a really interesting perspective to see, you know, from someone who is very much a current target for these things more than, you know, a lot of other places in the world.
Yeah, it was a really great get by Dmitry Smilyanets over there at The Record. And yeah, very, very interesting stuff. And I would highly recommend everybody go read that. Just a quick correction on last week. I think I said there were 25 arrests in that Revil roundup. The true number was 14. I think they hit 25 properties, though, which is why I got confused. But I apologize for that error. We got some other Ukraine news also from The Record, this one by Martin Matashak. The Treasury Department has imposed sanctions on 4 current and former Ukrainian government officials for engaging in Russian government-directed influence activities there. So that's kind of interesting that, you know, I feel like this is the Americans kind of saying, we know what you're up to.
Yes, we've certainly seen a few things in the mainstream media where it does look like the Americans are trying to, Americans and other allies, UK, trying to send a message to the Russians about quite how penetrated some of their, you know, command and control and political networks are, that they have this kind of information available and you know, trying to apply a little bit of pressure. Hopefully it works. But yeah, these guys were either cooperating with the FSB or have been approached by FSB to, you know, kind of participate in, you know, getting more access into Ukrainian government systems, or to kind of support, you know, what the end state of this Russia, the end state that Russia would like to get out of this situation. So I think at least one of them has already fled off to Moscow after previously being recruited. So yeah,
the fact looks like they got the right guy in that case.
Well, yeah, right, exactly. The Americans do seem to be keeping an eye on things pretty well there. So, yeah. But whether it's enough to make a difference, I just don't know.
Look, speaking of the FSB, they have rounded up some more cyber crooks, this time in connection with operating a carding forum called UniCC. So that's kind of interesting, because we're not used to seeing this sort of stuff happen in Russia necessarily. And we've got an interesting one to talk about here, which is an editorial from the Washington Post. And I mean the editorial. This is the Washington Post's view as written by the editorial board. And it's all about Russia's arrest of these Reval hackers, alleged Reval hackers. And, you know, this editorial argues, and I'm not sure that I believe it, this editorial sort of argues that the reason Putin rounded these guys up is to show America, well, look, we can be useful, or we can let them carry on to hurt you. I'm just not sure that I'm so convinced. Everybody seems to have a theory about why Russia acted. And look, it's much like I said last week. We just don't know. I mean, there's a bunch of theories that you can make fit. You know, could the Washington Post's theory here be true? Absolutely. Could it be something else? Also true. So I think we just don't know. But I think it is a sign of the times when you've got a paper like the Washington Post issuing editorials written by their editorial board talking about ransomware.
Yeah, that is definitely, it's a very interesting sign of the times. And I also found this, you know, analysis, this take on it. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly plausible, as you say, like it fits some of the available facts. But, you know, it could also easily be that maybe the Russians just don't care as much as the Americans and everybody else in the West does about ransomware. And this is just because someone didn't pay their fines or pay their bribes or, you know, or whatever else in time. Like, it could easily be that dumb, right? This isn't coordinated, sensible action designed to, you know, entice the US into thinking, well, maybe if we let them invade Ukraine, then they'll arrest some ransomwareists. I mean,
well, it's also possible there was someone in the FSB who always wanted to arrest them. And finally, the Yanks leaning on them that much and yapping about it at every opportunity has made that person win the argument internally. Yeah. Like, can we arrest these people yet? Come on.
Yeah, I mean, or it could be they needed to nationalize the capability so they could go use it for something else. You know, this could just be recruitment.
We just don't know.
We don't, right? I don't know. We need some more Russian sources to tell us what the hell is going on.
Yeah.
We're all confused.
Now, look, we've got an interesting story here. I guess it's somewhat related, isn't it? Merck has won a lawsuit that it launched against its insurer. And this was a story we covered at the time. Merck's insurer was refusing to cough up against its all-risks policy for damages incurred in the NotPetya attack. Merck's insurer said, look, this was an act of war involving a hostility between Russia and Ukraine, so we're not going to cover your costs. Merck sued, and it looks like they've won. And that's a lot of dollars on this lawsuit, because I think their total claim, their estimated damages were $1.4 billion, and their policy was for 1.75. So I think it's going to cost the insurer a fair bit. I guess from their perspective, it was worth litigating, but it is interesting that they lost, right?
Yeah, it is. And I mean, obviously, we've seen a lot of change in the insurance industry lately with them rewording policies, especially in, you know, around the cyber insurance specifically we've talked about. Yeah, in the case of more general insurance that, you know, presumably the language was written ages ago and hadn't really been updated to cover the state of the world. So this is certainly, I imagine, if you're an insurer, a thing that you're going to sit up and look at and go, well, crap. But as you say, like it was certainly worth a punt for $1 billion worth of insurance claim, $1.5 billion worth of insurance claim. And yeah, the fact that the judge came out and said, yes, that does seem like a reasonable interpretation. And especially when it's so ambiguous, you know, whether or not it was, you know, act of war, whether it was state coordinated, we still don't really have a great, like, I mean, an act of war that you don't come out and admit to, I guess, is still a gray area. And yeah, interesting that the judge decided that way too.
Yeah, Yeah, link to that one is in the show notes. Another one from Catalan here. Canada has confirmed an attack on its foreign affairs ministry. If you look at the early reporting, which comes from the Canadian publication Global News, it looks like they're claiming, so they have sources saying that this was a Russian APT.
Yes, and we don't really, I mean, the reporting is a little vague about what has actually happened inside the environment.
Because you read it and you're like, was this ransomware? Was this an APT thing? And then you sort of get into the story a bit and they're like, oh yeah, our sources say Russia.
Yes, and so who really knows? Obviously, the Canadians have been, you know, sticking their diplomatic oar in about the situation in Ukraine. So, you know, going and winding them up, I guess, is a thing that, you know, could be on a Russian APT's list of things to do. But yeah, we don't really know what's happened inside there, how long, you know, how bad, all that sort of thing. It's pretty vague, but you know, I guess having someone's foreign ministry owned by Russians is, you know, is a bad time.
Now, we got a weird one to talk about now. This one, I'm having a bit of trouble wrapping my head around it, Adam.
Yes, me too.
Apparently a US venture capital firm is in talks to acquire the rotting corpse of NSO. So this is an interesting thing because it's an American company. An American VC is looking at buying them, apparently for the sum of $300 million. And the idea is they're going to ditch all of their other contracts and just focus on the Five Eyes markets. And I'd imagine that would be sort of mostly the law enforcement market, because the sort of, you know, defense SIGINT side of that market is covered pretty well by other players. The really funny thing is the VC company is actually named Integrity Partners, which I just find this is the cherry on top of this story. But I mean, I sent this to you this morning because this is late breaking news. And you said exactly what I was thinking, which is how is this going to work?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, surely the presence of US sanctions against the NSO Group should preclude US venture capital money being used to bail them out. And I mean, maybe I don't understand how the process works. Like,
you could lobby the government to get them to allow this deal to proceed. Then you've got the leftover staff at NSO. I mean, I don't understand. Like, how is that a trustworthy organization that's just going to deliver for Five Eyes agencies?
Well, that's certainly the other half of the question, right? They said that they would just, like, fire all the existing customers so they're not selling anything to anyone and then only do Five Eyes, but yet you're going to deliver this out of Israel where, you know, I don't know what percentage of NSO staff are ex-Israeli mil or Gav or Spook.
Which for the law enforcement market might be okay, I guess, maybe.
But yeah, I mean, in terms of national interest, like if you're an Israeli working there and you've been, I don't know, it just would seem like a strange situation to be in Israel and only selling to Five Eyes and then have all of those very deep ties into the, you know, government and spook establishment there.
I mean, the US government wouldn't even let Checkpoint buy Snort, you know?
Yeah, right. NSO has come out and said that reports about this are full of tremendous inaccuracies and half-truths.
Yes. Well, yes. That's what they usually say. I mean, I would be surprised if their public affairs people don't literally have a rubber stamp that that actually says that. These are all lies. They've probably got a few, you know.
Yeah. We've got a committee that'll take responsibility for it internally, and we take the privacy and security of our customers, I mean, victims, I mean, very seriously. Yes.
Now, look, speaking of further scumbaggery on the internet, a third-party contractor that was doing work for the Red Cross, they got popped, and a bunch of information on quote-unquote highly vulnerable people was obtained. And Red Cross has come out and said, please don't further victimize these people, because this is a website where, you know, dispossessed people, refugees, etc., can try to find family members that they've lost contact with, right? So, you know, pretty important service. So they're saying, please don't share this data. Please don't leak it. Don't be dicks, basically, is what Red Cross is saying here. But I read this and I just think this feels like the sort of data that would be mostly of use to SIGINT agencies who are tracking the movement of various people moving among refugees in the Middle East. Yeah. That's what I think.
Yeah, which is a grim take, but I mean, yes, we're in such a weird world. Like this, this is a weird conversation.
I mean, they're looking for the guy. You know, my guess is this data would be useful if you're like, yeah, I'm not the butcher of Raqqa, ISIS commander. My name's Bob, and I'm a refugee. You know, like that's sort of the vibe.
Oh dear. It's
just. But is that the vibe you got from this as well, or do you think it was just someone who randomly SQL mapped this site and got the data?
I mean,
could be either, right?
It could be either, and I'm kind of, well, my initial feeling was I hope it's just a random SQL injector pull down the database, you know, and he goes, oh, actually, yeah, I can't sell this. None of these people have credit cards. But, yeah, your take is sadly also quite believable.
But that's the thing. I mean, if I were SIGINT, I'd be wanting to have a look at that stuff because you might find a few people who'd been up to some naughty stuff who are now trying to reconnect with their families, you know, and that's just, that is a place to look for that.
Dear, yeah, it's horrible, but yeah, I mean, yeah, you're probably right. That's so depressing.
APT 41, getting funky with the old UEFI boot kits. This is interesting. This is one that you would have scrolled past if you didn't get the APT 41 link.
Yeah, it is a really interesting story. So this is work from Kaspersky, where they were looking at some boot kits. So the thing that affects UEFI firmware during boot to charging the operating system to then, you know, allow them to do hacking. This particular piece of tooling is capable of infecting like the spy flash chips on the motherboard instead of storing it in like the EFI data partitions on the hard disks. And so the net result of this is when you get owned by, you know, Chinese APTs and then you go and, you know, reinstall the operating system, clear out your machine during incident response, that they're capable of surviving that because they've written things out to the flash. And there's been a few other examples of this done both in like general, you know, academia / hacking research and a few, you know, actual APT crews using it. But this being in the wild, being used by Chinese APT,
It's a sign that it's normal now, right? Because none of this is, and that's what I mean. Like it would be, whatever, you know, we've seen this sort of stuff before, but the fact that it's, I mean, APT 41 is kind of like a mainstream APT, if that makes sense.
Yes.
And seeing it move into the mainstream of like, God, talk about a letter soup, but, you know, APT TTPs, you know, it's again, sign of the times.
Yeah. And at the very least, like if you're rolling incident response now and you suspect, you know, any moderately sophisticated APT, you kind of have to think UEFI rootkits, you know, Trojan firmware and motherboards, like responding to that is very, very difficult. You know, even collecting, you know, images of flash chips on disk without having to, like, be able to do that in software is difficult enough. And then getting the expertise to be able to go actually do incident response. You know, people who've got hardware labs in-house and are capable of doing that analysis. And then there's the recovery process, like the percentage of organizations that are willing to accept a recommendation from their incident response people that says, okay, now you need to junk all the hardware in your entire enterprise and start from scratch.
Yeah, you need to throw that thing into a wood chipper is the remediation, right?
And I mean, you know, in government that can happen, but in private sector, I'd be really interested to hear from incident responders out there if you have ever been in a private sector org where that has been the serious recommendation and they've actually done it.
Mm. And then you wonder how insurance would come into that as well, right?
Well, yeah, right. And so the fact
if Mandiant tells you you've got a wood chipper, you know, half your desktops, like, can you claim that?
Well, and then also, even if you did decide to do that now, the supply chain situation of replacing half your corporate fleet or the entire of your fleet in one go, I mean, that would be, you know, more effective than ransomware in terms of the, you know, business damage and stuff. Like, that's...
Well, lucky they're being really lazy with their C2, so just drop those IPs at the border and hope for the best, I guess.
Yeah, but I know. We're just at the point where hardware-level incident response and then the consequent business impact of that is a thing we probably need to consider in a lot more cases than we ever have. And, you know, people aren't ready for even rolling their AD, you know, curb TGT over when they need to, let alone junking the entire fleet. Like
I mean, you'd probably be able to remediate this by reflashing, right? But it's going to be
just the cost of doing that, exactly, right? I mean, if you came to us and said, hey, can our hardware team reflash 3,000 laptops spy flash chips versus the cost of just buying 3,000 new laptops, I think we would be more expensive, which, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you'd hope the manufacturers would offer you those tools, but that ain't going to happen, right?
No.
And that's
what
the thing, that's going to have to change.
Like, and what if it's like Lenovo?
they just put the upgraded one on there, right?
I know, right? I mean, I don't know how you, I don't know how you'd recover from this.
Yeah.
Sucks. Sucks to be everybody.
Yeah, nice work, APT 41. Yeah, that was another Catalan one there, as usual. This week's show contains 40% content by volume of Catalan Kimpanu. Joe Cox has just got, I mean, this one we don't really need to talk about, but it's a good little write-up about how, you know, recovery flows for some of these services like Instagram and whatever are so bad that there's now this whole scam industry that's popped up claiming that they can get you account, you know, get your account access back, right? So anytime someone complains on Twitter, I'm locked out of my Instagram, these bots just pop up in as replies saying, we can get it back for you. It's $65. And most of them, they just take the money and run. But it's nice to see this written up. And, you know, honestly, there's almost like a market for a legitimate operator who can try to do this for you, because the big companies don't seem to be very good at fixing this.
No, there is certainly a niche there for a legit one of these. And I think the point that Joe Cox is making in this story is that people who DM you on Twitter when you mention it, probably not the reputable source to go to. Motherboard stood up a Twitter account that had no previous interaction with anyone and just said, hey, I lost my account. And then he collected some of the DMs that they got. And one of them was quite funny where the person, you know, says, hey, it's $65 to reset your account. Oh, and by the way, I have to purchase a firewall booster online, which is another $65.
It's a 3D firewall booster, isn't it?
Yes. And so, yeah, Joe Cox asks the guy, like, what's a firewall booster? Apparently, it's a 3D injection tool online, which we use to reset account network as fast would be done within 45 minutes.
There you go.
So good to know.
We've got to get one of those 3D injection firewall booster boosters. Tools.
Hell yeah. Firewall booster go. Booster. That's what I need.
Coming soon to a sponsored segment near you.
Yeah. All new risky business. Firewall booster.
Dear. E2EE is kicking up as an issue again in the UK. There is this new campaign called No Place to Hide. And look, it's all the usual sort of stuff. Companies need to make these tools safe before enabling E2EE. And I mean, there's nothing really that new here. We're still in this weird status quo holding pattern, but this has kicked up a few headlines in a few places this week. And you've got the usual people saying, oh, they just want to intrude in our lives. And then you've got the child safety campaigners saying, well, no, actually, this is a problem. But, you know, no one's moved the ball forward on this at all in years.
Yes, yeah, we are pretty much having the same debate, just in individual jurisdictions. This one stood out to me as mildly interesting, I guess, because the coalition that's kind of pushing this No Place to Hide campaign describes itself as a range of organizations from across society, including charities, safety tech companies, survivors of child sexual abuse, but they also got $720,000 worth of funding from the UK government, according to a Freedom of Information request. So that's, you know, that's quite a lot of funding from the government pushing this, and that's an interesting kind of twist to it, I suppose.
Now this one I really, really like. This is my feel-good story of the week, Adam, because I think this is the sort of thing governments can do to help organizations in their country that is genuinely useful. It's another one from Catalan on the record. The UK government is going to release scripts that will help organizations scan themselves for vulns, right? And their stated rationale is, hey, look, even when there's a proof of concept that comes out, like actually taking that thing and just using it to check your network for the presence of some sort of vulnerability, it's kind of like witchcraft to most people. So what we're going to do is write a bunch of scripts so that you can do this very easily. And I just think this is a terrific idea.
So they are going to write Nmap plugins and stick them up on GitHub. They're going to fund, presumably, other people to write them where it's appropriate. And then there's a bunch of guidance about, you know, kind of the quality standard required for these Nmap plugins. And obviously using Nmap is just a really, you know, it's a tool that nearly everybody in the security industry is familiar with. It's standalone, straightforward, and they've got some requirements for the code that they're going to write, such as, you know, being standalone and being largely, you know, as false positive free as possible and, you know, to a good standard. So yeah, seems like a really good initiative and, you know, nice to see, you know, them contributing to the, you know, the wider ecosystem around Nmap, because I mean that tool's been around for a long time and really it's just a, you know, such a workhorse. Good to see it being supported this way.
Hello, Fyodor, if you are listening.
Hi
stuff.
To you, guy.
Now we got one here from Brian Krebs. I actually had a quick chat to Brian this morning, and he pointed me to a tweet of his, which is a video of WazaWaka, the initial access broker that he was writing about recently, declaring war on him and Dimitri from the record, apparently. So, you know, that whole thing's got really weird. The guy's like straight up. It's the guy that Brian doxed. And you could see, you know, he published his photo. It's that guy saying, I'm declaring war on you. You know, I'm coming after you. I'm taking to the internet to tell you to your face sort of stuff in Russian. It's very funny. But he has another story here, which is very interesting, which is the tax office in the United States, the IRS, is going to require selfies for online access using like a live mobile device. And I think, okay, I mean, let's let them run with this, Adam.
Yeah, they are. Of course, the IRS has been the center of quite a lot of identity theft over the years and the quality of their authentication, you know, given the amount of data breaches of, you know, social security numbers and all that kind of thing in the US. You know, obviously, they have some very real problems to solve. And they've integrated with this third party, you know, like private sector company called ID.me, which appears to be used by a bunch of, you know, government and other things in the US that implements, you know, relatively high quality, I guess, authentication where you have to upload copies of documents and, yes, eventually, you know, provide a live picture of yourself so they can programmatically compare it against the, you know, photographic ID that you provided, the other government ID, and if necessary, get an actual person, you know, on like a video conference to make sure that your face looks real and that you're not just a, you know, a bunch of JPEGs or some machine learning or something like that. And Brian, of course, you know, being the good reporter that he is, went through the process himself of signing up for this thing and talks through some of the steps and how long it took. And at one point he gets shunted off into the queue to do like human face-to-face video call validation. And it gets the, like, your estimated wait time is 3 hours and 27 minutes. But he had, like, emailed the guy that founded this company. And then some engineer got back to him, like, minutes later and was like, ah, oh, we'll just put you in the special queue. So, yeah, Brian's using his, you know, journalistic street cred there to the jump the queue. And he's a great pains to say that he didn't really mean to do that. He tried to be, you know, asked to be left.
Come on, Brian, you were flashing your J card, buddy.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, obviously, we do need better standards of authentication for critical stuff like taxes and other government services. And as you say, like,
let's see.
Let's see how well it goes. Yeah. I mean, there's obviously some concerns about a private company being so involved in such a lot of, you know, biometrics and records and things like that. And that said, you know, Brian talks through this particular company and they do seem to have, you know, better than average, we're not going to use your data for monetizing, we're not going to sell it, we're not going to provide it to marketers. So it looked more reassuring than I would have expected from a private sector company doing this kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we'll have to see.
ID.me, isn't it?
ID.me, yeah. And they say they've got, what, like 67 mil customers already, or users, I suppose, already. So, I mean, I guess it must kind of work.
Well, it's good too because, you know, you could insist that everyone get a YubiKey, right? But then you're going to have a process for when people, like, lose their YubiKeys. So I can understand you can't lose your face. Well, you can, but it's less likely to happen.
Less common.
Less common, that's right. So, yeah, no, interesting.
And I'd be interested to see the, like, the machine learning, you know, kind of ways of going, of getting past this. Like, whether we do see some academic research into, you know, that kind of live, you know, bypassing live validation with machine
learning.
Maybe,
but it's adding friction, right? Like, that's the point.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, so. Yes. And slowing it down, because you have to wait 3 hours to get your account lit up. Then, yeah, that slows the fraud down at the very least.
Now, this one is interesting. We're talking about the long tail of Log4Shell exploits popping up in stuff. This one looks like SolarWinds may have missed an instance in some of its software or had a quick look at it and said, well, users can't get to that bit of code. So what an enterprising attacker did was they found a bug that would let them access that bit of code in the SolarWinds software and then started exploiting it. And Microsoft detected this and reported it to them and they've now patched it. That seems to me to be the obvious explanation for what's happening, what happened here. Is that what you think happened as well, Adam?
Yeah, that seems to be how it's reported. There was some kind of input validation bypass in the login process that they were using to then, which was previously unreported, to then reach a place where they could then inject characters to trigger the log4j bug. So, yeah, I think your read is probably right there. It is funny, every time I see the ServView, this is their ServView file sharing product, which for those of us who have been around on the internet for 20 years, like that was a Windows FTP server 25 years ago. And seeing that name is just, it's so weird that it's still a thing. Mm. And now they've bodged Log4j into it. So
now with Java.
I know, exactly. You didn't make it better.
Dan Gooden for Ars is reporting on some attacker who managed to backdoor a bunch of WordPress add-ons and stick them in a legit repository. And of course, it was something like 40 themes and 53 plugins affected. And of course, dozens of websites went and installed them. I mean, this is par for the course, but I think it's a very, you know, supply chain's a big issue this year. So I wanted to mention that. But I mean, you don't always need to do supply chain stuff for great victory. Sometimes you just need some great bugs that no one's found. And an organization that's been just doing such wonderful Linux security research over the last few years is Qualys. And boy, did their team punch out a good one, Adam. And I had not heard of this. You sent it to me. We've just basically got their text file here. And this is a Linux local privesc in basically every distro going back to 2009.
Yeah, it's just such a beautiful bug. And I don't know, I think I've said this on the show probably half a dozen times. Like, I don't know who it is at Qualys that is the like super old school Linux local privesc person that's doing this research, but just chef kiss for this one. This is a bug in a thing called Policy Kit, or now called Polkit, which is just, you know, kind of boring Linux plumbing that is used by all the distributions. And this is there's a SUID binary that's capable of running other programs. It's kind of meant to do the similar sort of thing as sudo, I guess, like allow you to run a program at a higher privilege if you're permitted to do so. And this is it's a memory corruption bug, but it's not like stack smashy or heap overflowy or whatever. It's memory corruption with like environment variable injection leading to being able to provide a, you know, shared library that gets loaded in and then run with higher privilege, which is, it's memory corruption, but it's not unreliable. It's like beautiful, going to work cross-platform. Just such a wonderful class of, you know, wonderful example of a beautiful local privisc. And yeah, net result is any user to root on essentially all Linux since, you know, 2009, which is, it's just, it's beautiful. It's beautiful.
And, like, and, you know, and yet has not made the headlines at all.
Yeah, and yet, you know, literally every Linux admin on the planet needs to patch this if you're a multi-user Linux box.
Yeah. Which
hopefully you've got the message that multi-user Unix is just not a thing that you should ever rely on for, you know, a privilege boundary. But, of course, there are many. And just, you know, the heart eyes emoji? Like, I saw this and I was just full heart eyes emoji. Like, this is just everything I want in a Linux local privilege. It's beautiful.
It's funny, right? Because when I talked to Jake King at CMD about like how people tend to use bugs like this, it's not attackers coming from outside. It's people with restricted privilege, internal teams who've got the shits and just want to do something.
Just need to get stuff done. Yeah, ain't got no time for change control gated, you know.
Exactly.
And just-in-time shell access.
It's people inside who just want to go around policy, basically love this stuff. So yeah, if you've
There's exploits out there. So if you are working a telco and jump host won't let you get to where you need to go, here you go, buddy.
You can make that change now.
You can be the change. No change control. Just do it live.
We'll do it live.
No. We'll do it live. Fuck it. Do it live. I'll write it and we'll do it live. F***ing thing sucks.
Oh, yeah. GitHub. There's a GitHub so actions floor. And, you know, again, this is the sort of stuff. It's been written up by the Daily Swig here. But, you know, we see lots of write-ups about various bugs and whatnot. But stuff like this is kind of a big deal. This was a GitHub actions floor that would allow code to be approved without review. And GitHub has now cleared that up.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, obviously bugs in CI/CD pipelines or any kind of DevOps-y or, you know, kind of automated build things are really, you know, one of the great places to do supply chain sorts of attacks. And this one where there was like a combination of like being able to use branching to get around code review process and then push stuff out into other branches that you weren't supposed to be able to whilst kind of approving your own code. Like, boring business logic flaw if it was in, you know, banking software. But when it's in GitHub, like, that's interesting. So yeah, good to see it get fixed. Good to see that people are doing the research into some of these, you know, kinds of CI/CD systems. But yeah, if you sat on that bug and you had it like and actually just straight up work like they described, like, I wish I wasn't tempted not to report it.
Yeah.
It's just.
Now, what is GitHub Actions anyway? Because they keep talking about how this is a bug in GitHub Actions.
Yeah, so this is their like add-on thing that does like normal CI/CD pipeline where you can set actions to happen when commits occur and workflows and approvals and those kinds of things.
Yeah, so it's the CI/CD bit, not just all repos.
Yes, yeah. And I think there is also some interaction between when you have on-prem GitHub versus the cloud one. And yeah, like, I don't understand all of the prerequisites necessary, but what I want, which is just to be able to push code into anyone's GitHub repo, like, if it's quite that, I mean, that would just be, it'd be lovely. Wonderful.
I don't really want to talk about this one. I just want to more address it. There was a bug in a third-party bit of software Tesla owners use called Tesla Mate, lets you do a few interesting things, get some more telemetry from your car or whatever. But there's like a server component that people were running on their home systems, and that was accessible to the internet, and someone found a way to, you know, pop shell in it. And it just blew up on Twitter. Oh my God, you can do stuff with, you know, anything with Tesla in it makes news. But again, this was third-party software. I think the guy found like a dozen instances of this thing globally. And I'm looking at a TechCrunch story in front of me. But I mean, this is just, it barely rates as news, I kind of feel like.
Yeah, like this is just some like homebrew, I can make API calls to your Tesla account, retrieve data and give you like a dashboard thing. And if you chose to run it at home and then also put it on the internet, I mean, I don't know that it's a PHP app, but it seems like the sort of thing that's probably just a like, you know, PHP MySQL kind of piece of trash full of bugs. And yeah, if you put it on the internet, you could own some people. And I think like the guy who found it said he found like, what, 25 instances or something. So
yeah.
Yeah, really not worth the flurry of
the Twitter ink. The Twitter ink that was spilled on that one, yeah. Because I think that was I think that was like last week. We could have had that in the show, but I didn't. And then it's still going. So that's why. If you wondered why we didn't cover it, that is why. Now, we did have a notable bugs section in this week's news run sheet, but we're kind of running out of time. I'll just leave the links in to this week's show notes. There's one about gamers popping each other via the Dark Souls servers to the point where they had to take those servers down. And the joke is, well, it could be the next Log4j because we know what happened after all of that exploitation. There's also a high-risk Nginx controller vulnerability that's been fixed by F5. CentOS has patched an RCE bug chain in its web panel. What else have we got? Oh, now, this one you did actually want to talk about, which is a bug chain in Cisco Prime servers that leads to RCE. And you said this one's worth talking about.
Yeah, this is a beautiful thing. So Cisco Prime is a like network device management product. So like if you have a Cisco CellNet or a big fleet of Cisco devices in people's houses, Prime is the sort of thing that you would use to do centralized management. Obviously a very trusted piece of equipment. If you can pop it, you're in the middle of the telco or the middle of the ISP and you win the entire ISP. And our normal advice to people who run this sort of software is like just assume that anyone who can talk to it probably has root and can do anything they like. And just kind of segment it, put controls around it, and limit access as much as possible. The bugs that were reported here is a bug chain that starts with cross-site scripting, but the input vector for the cross-site scripting is SNMP, the Simple Network Management Protocol. Yeah. So you would spin up a device on a network that's managed by Cisco Prime, or you control a device that's already managed by Prime, and then you stick a cross-site scripting payload in probably the SNMP device name or something, which gets executed as script in the back end of Cisco Prime. And then they've got a bug chain to leverage that up to stealing some cookies for an admin, to file upload, to upload a, you know, Java JSP script, to remote code execution.
Which, if the thing is appropriately segmented, shouldn't actually be a problem. But, yeah, that's a
big if. I mean, in this case, if they are designed to be taking data from a customer device, which, you know, it's a network managing product, so like the input vector is there and you're willing to work with getting out, you know, through all the other egress controls or whatever else, like leveraging this up to remote code exec wins you the entire telco or internet service provider or whoever else.
Yeah, if your shell if you've got like a DNS-based shell or something.
Yes, exactly, right? I mean, there's going to be channels to get out of this thing, because especially like it is meant to talk to a whole bunch of network gear. Yeah. So like, you know, maybe this is not a thing that we're going to see a ransomware crew use, but like if you're a sophisticated actor or a pen tester who really likes ruining telcos, this is just...
Well,
like,
gee, who's sophisticated and likes owning telcos, Adam?
I mean, I've had some other Cisco Prime bugs in my time, and I looked at this one, I thought, yeah, I feel good about this. I mean, you can probably just, you know, Monday one your way, welcome one your way into the, you know, front end of the telco instead. But if you want to do it the hard way, but the kind of more cool way, this is beautiful.
Yeah. I love champagne it. Hacking, basically.
Yes. Exactly.
Now cue the Benny Hill music, because we're going to do a short section on crypto. the not crypto means encryption side of crypto. Apparently OpenSea went down. This is where people buy, sell, trade NFTs, and people couldn't see a lot of their NFTs on Twitter as well, because there's some sort of NFT integration with Twitter. Anyway, that's just funny.
And nothing of value was lost. So
my apes, they're all gone. What else have we got here? So this was interesting. I saw this one kicking around on Twitter, and Catalan wrote it up, where there was a bug in OpenSea which would allow people to basically, like, say someone listed an NFT for like 30 grand or whatever, pulled the listing and then later listed it for 100 grand, there was a bug that would allow you to basically buy it at the previously listed price. So an attacker was buying stuff discounted and then on selling it and making money, which is just crazy to me because I'm thinking, okay, so you're still going to buy an ape for 30 grand instead of 100 and you're going to really be relying on someone actually buying it again from you at more than that. That's seems pretty crazy. But, you know, pretty classic sort of bug here.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen all sorts of business logic bugs in both smart contracts or in this case where there's a, you know, there's a blockchain-backed system but also a parallel, you know, non-blockchain system that's running the, like, front-end storefront or whatever, and those two kind of get out of whack with the business logic rules that don't, you know, match between the two things. But overall, like, this whole buying a monkey for $30,000 thing, I mean, I reckon go steal the monkey. You know, you wouldn't download a cop car, but... Download a monkey. That's what I say.
Download a monkey. You'll get a real monkey.
I guess you could have a real monkey for 30 grand. Yeah.
And crypto.com has confirmed a major hack and apparently lost 34 million bucks. That's what, like, the one we talked about last week where they were being a bit weaselly. Now they have copped to what happened. 34 mil. Not a bad payday for whoever was that.
And there's so little money for crypto bros that they're just going to cover it. You know, no big deal. Everyone else will just pay for it. It's just the cost of doing business. And yeah, some hacker has, you know, 4,000 ETH or whatever, and they can go spend it. So,
woo-hoo.
I mean, why remind me again why I have to write reports for a living, and I could, like, just go steal internet monkey money.
I remember the first time crypto stuff, you know, was you know, what was that, like 2016, 2017, that time frame when crypto stuff really took off. And there are all those people who are making millions of dollars by hacking the WordPress sites for initial coin offerings and just changing the Bitcoin address on the page and then make like $10 million. And we should be doing that.
Yeah, like, why? We were into crime before it was cool.
Anyway. Anyway, and Lorenzo over at Vice has a couple of stories here, two stories. Someone found some bug on a company called Multichain, or is it an organization called Multichain? But it's one of those things that allows you to chain hop with different cryptocurrencies, and someone found a bug in it and, you know, frauded like $1 million or something. And then the people begged for it back, and I think they got their money back. Is that what happened?
I think the guy was, whoever did it was like, saying, hey, I'll send you back 80% and I'll just keep the rest as a, you know, I was keeping your money safe because there were bugs in the platform that you was holding your money and I'm going to give it back to you. But see, other people could have stolen it in the meantime. So you're going to pay me a 20% fee for protecting your money from hackers.
That's going to sound really good in front of a judge.
And of course, it was exacerbated because the company or the organization, whatever in question, like their mitigation involved like telling users to log in and fix their API keys or something. So, like, if you didn't sit on crypto Reddit or whatever, then you wouldn't know that you needed to go, like, secure your own bank. Like,
yeah.
I don't understand how this is the basis for a financial system.
All right, Adam, that's actually it for the week's news. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun, and we'll do it all again next week.
All right. Thanks very much, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's security news. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Dan Guido, the co-founder of Trail of Bits, the security engineering firm. Trail of Bits does all sorts of interesting security engineering work, but over the last few years, they've wandered into a niche that not too many companies are really serving, the cryptocurrency and blockchain space. And as you just heard in the news, they could use a little security engineering, some of these organizations. So Trail of Bits started off kind of doing stuff like smart contract auditing, but that was years ago. And what started off as them looking at this stuff because it was kind of novel and interesting has actually turned into a fairly substantial chunk of their business. Something like 15 Trail of Bits engineers work on blockchain security work full time. And as you'll hear, by the way, they're hiring. They're at about 100 staff now, and they're going to try to fill some leadership positions. So Dan will talk about that in this interview also. Anyway, in addition to the smart contract stuff and issues like that, there is some real heavy lifting to do on the actual engineering side. And one big issue, according to Dan, is that a lot of these newfangled zero-knowledge protocols being used in the blockchain world are being implemented by engineers straight from academic papers. So there's no real way to check if an implementation is actually valid compared to a spec because the spec doesn't exist. So they've written an implementation guide for some of this stuff called ZKDocs or ZKDocs. And that's what Dan joined me to talk about. Here he is.
A lot of people ask us to do cryptography audits. And when we do them, a big concern is always, does my implementation of this match the specification of it? And the specification they're referring to is usually an academic paper. But like in the past, we have done those reviews and we have matched up the implementation to the specification. The next obvious question
is the specification any good? Right?
Yeah. Is it right? Is it good? Is it easy to follow? Is it clearly specified? Is it specified to the level of detail that I need to implement the code? And the answer, more frequently than you would expect with cryptographic software, is no, it's actually not easy to follow. It's not correct. It's poorly specified. It doesn't give the details necessary. And you kind of just have to like ask your buddies, hey, do you think this thing works right? And there's this incredible culture of knowledge sharing and collaborative work in the field of cryptography, but that's not really effective in the long term, right? That's kind of a tactic, not a strategy. Like at the top level of this, you actually need guidance you can trust. You need guidance that's easy to follow. You need guidance that's comprehensive. And that was just completely lacking when we were starting to work more and more with these zero knowledge systems. A lot of the idea for this came from a paper we saw presented at Real World Crypto back in 2020, which was an attack on the Helios e-voting system. And they had an issue in their Fiat Shamor transform. We looked at it and wrote up a review of that paper that we were going to publish. But when we thought about it a bit more, we asked ourselves, why did they do that? These are really diligent cryptographers. How did they encounter that issue? And we went back to the original paper and realized that, oh my God, that's why they did that. The original paper's incorrect. And when you look at it, it's got like 30 different instructions you're supposed to follow. And like step four is go read this other paper. And then step five is, well, you can probably just do it this way, like some abstract guidance that doesn't actually pertain to implementing it at all. So it's just a minefield. And that necessitated us to look for issues down the road that those sorts of recommendations could create, as well as start to address the root cause problem with a knowledge repository of our own.
Well, I mean, for people who've been in InfoSec a long time, I mean, there was a point where no one would really look at things like mod SSL, right? Because you're like, wow, very smart cryptographers put this thing together. Why would you look for bugs there? Especially at the time when you could find bugs in like Core Apache and IIS and things like that. And then eventually people actually started taking a look at it and they shook out all these awful, awful bugs, right? And thankfully that eventually, you know, we're in a much better place where it comes to with that sort of stuff. But I can see how when you're talking about maybe the slightly more obscure stuff, where you're going to have a lot of those problems, right? Where you're going to have the implementation problems. And then you're also going to have that, yeah, that issue that the spec itself is not necessarily particularly detailed in all of the areas where it should be.
Yeah, it's so much worse because with something like SSL, it is specified. There is a document. You can go on like, you know, NIST, RFCs, ISO standards, whatever. There is somebody somewhere that has written down what they think this should do and put it into a document that uses all those standard like should, may not, cannot. And it tells you and everybody agrees on what it's supposed to do. But there's now an extreme desire to use newer forms of cryptography. I'd call it modern cryptography. It's no more public key encryption. It's no more SSL. Now it's stuff like Schnorr's identification protocol, Fiat Shamir transforms. It's Geralt's identification protocol. It's like all these stuff that you never learned in school. There aren't really good textbooks written for it. There's no like NIST standard to go and look up for how to use any of this stuff. There's not an RFC I can go check. And you're just implementing stuff based on the academic author of a paper that created the technique. And that person's not an engineer. They're a cryptographer. They are an analyst. They are somebody who specializes in math. And they're not going to really be able to specify exactly how you should implement the code.
So can you give us an example, like a war story, a case study of where this has become an issue for someone?
Yeah. So zero knowledge in general is just an incredible field. And it's kind of in the field of privacy preserving encryption. Privacy preserving encryption is the most exciting field in cryptography right now, because people have these incredibly valuable data sets and data that they don't want to keep, they don't want to share, and further exposing it increases risk for everybody. So one way to deal with that fact that, hey, I've got this massive, you know, pollution that I'm trying to mop up all the time and not let spill outside my company, is to use privacy preserving encryption. But really, it's the blockchain folks. The blockchain folks have created these extraordinarily surveillance friendly systems, and also these systems that heavily depend on things like proof of work and have to verify all these transactions, where you can use some of these techniques like zero knowledge proofs to greatly accelerate the speed that blockchains operate at. So there is intense pressure right now to use and to develop and to increase the speed of all of these types of techniques coming from the blockchain community, which has created a revolution in cryptography in the last 5 years. But some of the ways these things fail are actually they're in blockchain systems. People create a layer one blockchain, like a Bitcoin, whatever, and then they use zero knowledge proofs in order to allow people to transfer tokens to people anonymously or to speed up transactions so you don't have to do a second round of verification when you're trying to prove blocks. And people have exploited these in practice. I know of one really good one that kind of came up on our team's radar from the Zcoin project, which is not unlike Zcash, but it's a same but different kind of blockchain system, where they actually had attackers that were performing cryptographic attacks against that cryptocurrency to create new currency for themselves.
Isn't it great that we finally found somewhere where cryptographers can be evil? You know, it's taken a long time, but now we've finally got an attack surface in the encryption space that's big enough that they can roll like, you know, like they're Alan Turing, but evil.
Yeah, these things are extremely valuable at this point, because whatever your feelings are about blockchain and about cryptocurrency, it is here to stay. There are people using it, and there are people using it for nefarious purposes and for quote unquote legitimate purposes. There's like, fast forward 5 years from now, it's still going to be an issue.
It'll be a thing, right? Like, even if that's just banks using it for doing settlements or whatever the hell it is, you're right. It's here to stay.
Yeah. And North Korea is still going to be stealing it to pay for their nuclear program. And the Russians will still be using it. And the ransomware will still be using it. So it kind of like pays to be familiar with the technology these things are built with. And one of those core pieces of technology these days is now zero knowledge proofs.
Yeah.
So we've been reviewing those systems for blockchains and for other software. And what we came up against was we'd been reviewing these systems for adherence to the specification for a while, but a few different factors came into view where we realized that actually a lot of the techniques that people are recommending in the original papers are not actually what you should follow. That there are some bugs that passed peer review that nobody had looked at or fully understood the ramifications of for 20, 30, 40 years. And one of those was in a specification for, or not a specific, an academic paper for Fiat-Shamour transforms, which is kind of a key building block for the zero-knowledge ecosystem. And that's what resulted in, ultimately, the ZK-Docs program, because people are actually really interested in making sure their code matches the spec or matches the paper. So they're motivated to do the right thing. It's just that in doing the right thing, they did the wrong thing because the original documentation was incorrect.
So you're trying to come up with some more technically formal documentation for some of these academic specs. I think that's the TLDR here.
Yeah, we want to be the implementer's guide for all of this non-standard crypto that people are trying to implement.
Yeah. And what does that look like? Like, is this free guidance? Is this one of the things that Trail of Bits does and puts out there publicly? I imagine you would be paid to do a lot of these reviews, and then perhaps some of that knowledge winds up in something open. Is that how it works?
Absolutely. So we do a lot of these reviews. There's a huge amount of time that engineers get when they work with us to do internal research and to work on tools and techniques and projects for the company's benefit and their team's benefit and to develop themselves. And one of the areas that our cryptography team has invested in as a team is to maintain this repository of ZK docs, where we have, we hope, a system that ensures that no one implementing this kind of non-standard cryptography has to do it simply by reading the original academic paper.
Yeah. Now, so I'm guessing that's a GitHub.
It is on GitHub. We made a web front end in Hugo. It's actually really cool because it's interactive. So you can click into the proofs and you can kind of like change the labels of different variables in the math system that you're looking at and make it match whatever paper that you're trying to to implement against as your guide, so you can get a one-to-one view of it.
And how do people find it?
ZKDocs.com.
ZKDocs. So we would say in Australia, ZKDocs.com. So that's where people can find it. Now, I did just note that you were talking about how engineers have a great time at Trail of Bits and they get to do all of this interesting stuff. And you're hiring at the moment, right? Which I guess is one of the reasons you're talking about the wonderful working environment that is Trail of Bits.
Yeah. So we're definitely hiring for engineers, but new in 2022 is we're hiring for leadership. Trail of Bits has become so large and has so many opportunities that it's pursuing that we need a stronger team of leaders at the top of the company to help direct our pursuit of those opportunities. So we're hiring for people like a chief scientist. We're looking for people that do marketing. We're looking for people that do sales. We're looking for people, a VP of operations. We're building out all the infrastructure that we need to carry Trail of Bits to the next stage of growth, which is probably going to be at least 2 times our current size, where we're 80 now. So yeah. I think we'll be 150 in a blink of an eye.
Yeah, well, it gets real once you're over 30. That's what they say, right?
Yeah, that was a huge inflection point, 30. But as we've scaled up, I think I'm reaching my limits faster than I expect. I do a whole lot around here, but the VP of operations, I think, is a really key role to fill, as well as probably a recruiter. So for the people that are listening, if you're adjacent to the engineering work going on in the field and fill any of these roles, I would love to talk to you.
All right. Well, I'll drop a link in to the jobs page for Trail of Bits, and you can check out zkdocs.com to have a look at some of the work that Trail of Bits has done there. Dan Guido, it's always a pleasure, my friend. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
That was Dan Guido of Trail of Bits there, chatting about ZKDocs, and you can find that work at zkdocs.com, zkdocs.com. And that is it for this week's edition of the Risky Business Podcast. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back next week with more security news and analysis, but until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.